And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very first super special inaugural episode of Listen to the Prophets, a Two True Freaks Star Trek Monthly Monday spinoff podcast thing. Yes, our first episode ever. We've included it with the Demonza Corps higher-ups and Two True Freaks co-host Scott Gardner, who gave us his blessing to do the show with the statement, "Thank God I don't have to sit through that shit ever again." Spectacular! And since...
Talk about setting your stall out early.
I don't think that's his exact words. I think it was more profane, but I'll just...
I can't believe that he swore at you in Disneyland.
It was under his breath. It was kind of the Hail Hydra moment almost. And since this is without a doubt the first episode we've ever done, I don't know how much more I can emphasize that, we're going to take a look at the first two episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, a story entitled Emissary. And of course, when I say we are going to take a look at these two episodes, I of course mean myself, Sean Engel, and my two celestial co-hosts, Mr. Andrew Leyland and Mr. Paul Spataro. Hey guys.
How's it going?
Hello.
Wow, the enthusiasm factor is just amazing.
It's off the charts, baby.
Okay. Yes.
To actually put the enthusiasm where it really should be. Somehow that we worked out that we're doing this show is, to me, just like the greatest thing. Because if the podcasting gods came down to me and said, what topic do you want to cover? And you could have any two people as your co-hosts, I'd be sitting here right now doing this show.
Wow.
So, we're good.
That's really sweet, because I was expecting a punchline there.
No punchline at all. I am thrilled to be doing this with you guys.
I'm humbled. I've got to say, I feel the same way, Paul. I really do.
I'd like to, but I can't.
I'm contractually obligated because Scott said you have to put some hate in this show, so I'm going to be the one. No, I love Deep Space Nine. After the original series, Deep Space Nine is my favorite of the Star Trek franchises, and I'm glad that I'm getting to talk about it, and I'm especially glad I'm getting to talk about it with you guys, as evidenced by the fact that we're recording this at ungodly hours of the night for all of us. So yes,
anybody who ever listens to any episode of this show as they come out, never forget we're in three different time zones.
Mm-hmm. So trying to work this out where we're all here on the air at the same time is practically a miracle. So it takes a lot of doing to get this done, but the fact that we love doing it just means that we don't care about the time differences. It's awesome.
Yeah, for me, I think Deep Space Nine is probably my favourite after the original as well, because I think it's an excellent science fiction television show that happens to be Star Trek, which is why I think it has this divisive reputation amongst certain Star Trek fans. There's an awful lot of it that you can point to and go, well, would Star Trek really do that? And I actually think that's what the show and the franchise, which I hate calling it, but whatever, needed at this point. I'm one of those people that thinks The Next Generation was derivative for 2 years, excellent for two or three years, and then a bit crap again. Whereas I think Deep Space Nine it struggles in its first couple of seasons, and you do see it trying to find its legs. But once it finds them, it never looks back, and it doesn't try to be any other kind of show. Whereas there are episodes of Voyager you can look at and go, well, why did they not just carry on doing the Next Generation?
Mm-hmm.
If this is what they wanted to do. Whereas with Deep Space Nine, it's a completely different feel. It's a completely different cast. It's a completely different dynamic. It's a completely different kind of science fiction television show. And I think you can argue that without Deep Space Nine, you don't get the new Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And I we'll talk about it a little bit more after we get to the episode when we start going through it. But I think a lot of the criticism of the show is that it is not true to Gene Roddenberry's original viewpoint. But I think there are aspects of it that are true to it. And like I said, we'll get into that a little bit more when we actually discuss the episode.
Yeah, I can't agree with you guys more. It is a departure from Star Trek or from the Next Generation, but it's a welcome departure. It trod new ground. It was innovative. It went to places that you wouldn't see in a normal Trek show, and it did it really well. So I have no complaints about the show, and I'm glad we're going to be covering it. But you know, if you don't mind, surprisingly enough, this being our first episode and all, wink, we've got an email. And in fact, I might as well go ahead and mention this. We've also got an email address. So if you guys do want to write to this show specifically, the email address is listentotheprophets@gmail.com. That's listentotheprophets, T-O, all one word, @gmail.com. So if you guys want to send us an email, tell us how we're doing, tell us how we can improve the show, tell us you want Sean to shut up, I'd be more than happy to have your emails on the show. What?
Oh, yeah, is that what we're actually calling it?
Yeah, we're calling it
Listen. All right, okay, because I just threw that out as a gag when we did the non-linear episode.
Well, no, I...
What?
There is no non-linear episode. That episode hasn't happened yet.
And will never happen.
See, I'm surprised.
Has already happened.
That's true.
In the future.
Linear time is subjective.
It's already happened in the future.
So Paul gets two first episodes.
That's true.
He's like the original Star Trek.
It all comes
again. I am
Kirk.
All things to all people.
Yes.
So does that mean we're going to have to cover Way of the Warrior again? You know, because I wouldn't mind that, but yeah.
I was thinking about that the other day, and I think we wait until we get there and we see if we feel like we have greater insight. Because if we do, then I think we should redo it. Okay. If we feel like we're going to just say the same things over again, then we'll just pass it right up and go on to the next episode.
Sounds like a plan to me.
When we get there, if we decide that, no, I want to stay in bed this morning, we don't do it again.
Maybe we just post that episode again.
Yes!
That works perfectly for me.
You could re-edit it and just cut out all the references to it being an ongoing show.
I could do that. Yeah, that wouldn't be a problem. But yeah, surprisingly enough, even though this is our first episode, we've got an email. And this one comes from fellow Two True Freaks podcast member, Mr. Luke Giaconetti. Do you want to do some sort of Luke Giaconetti, you know, some say thing, Andy? Or is that...
Some say that his favorite character in Deep Space Nine is Jakar.
All we know is he's
and called. That his favorite starship appear on the show is the Cylon Raider. But all we know is he's called Luke Giaconetti.
Oh, good. His letter starts out, "Hi, Andy and Sean and Paul," but I didn't have an email for him, but I would have included him on too. So he included you sort of tangentially, Paul. He writes,
"That's fine."
He said, "I just wanted to say that I really loved your quote-unquote latest installment of Listen to the Prophets." See, Luke knows that we've done, you know, 37 episodes before this one. "I thought you were all pitch perfect in making it sound like a show which has been on the air for a couple of years." It was on the air for a couple of years. What are you talking about, Luke?
Yeah, you just didn't hear it.
"And your coverage of the episode and the comic was a lot of fun. I would love to hear more of this show." Well, guess what? You're going to.
Like it
or not. Be careful what you wish
yes.
for.
"I never caught on with Deep Space Nine all that much. I got into the Next Generation era at Star Trek right around the last season of the Next Generation, so I missed a lot of the early episodes of Deep Space Nine. I tried to watch it, but I always felt like I had missed something when I'd sit down to watch an episode. Whereas Voyager, I watched from Caretaker pretty much straight through for several years until I went to college, and then my viewing became spottier. I want to watch Deep Space Nine and give it a fair shake, but that has not happened yet. Well, I actually had a conversation with Chris Honeywell, and he said this show was probably going to give him an impetus to start watching Deep Space Nine. So I hope that, you know, you'll take that upon yourself as well, Luke, you know, listening to the show and getting a chance to watch the episodes along as we cover them. Also, I have to say, if anyone on Two True Freaks is going to do a Voyager show, I think we know it's going to be me. Well, I would say go ahead and do it, Luke. You know, if Scott doesn't mind us doing, you know, Deep Space Nine, I'm certain, you know, he'd be happy if someone did a Voyager show. Well, I don't know. Scott doesn't have the sort of negative feelings that we all kind of had about Voyager, so he might be more likened to do that.
I mean, if Scott was up for it, that would almost make a nice companion piece to this, the same way they do the original and Next Generation together.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering what they're going to be doing, because they're pretty much coming to the end of the original series episodes. So I don't know whether they're just going to go into Voyager after that, or, you know, what they're going to do once they are.
I'm figuring they could fill about 15 episodes worth of time with them going with the random number generator and just keep finding out that it keeps coming up with episodes they've already done until they finally hit the ones that they need to do.
I'm certain Scott would love it if they did the Cloud Minders again. That would just be awesome. But Luke, thanks for writing in. We appreciate your emails. And like I said, if you'd like to email the podcast, it's listentotheprophets@gmail.com. But that does it for emails. We'll close that out. And if you guys are ready, I've got a little preamble before we get into the episode that I basically cribbed off some website, and I'm going to read here if you guys are ready for that.
I'm raring to go.
Okay. Conceived in 1991, shortly before Gene Roddenberry's death, Deep Space Nine centers on the formerly Cardassian space station Tarok Nor. After the Bajorans have liberated themselves from the long and brutal Cardassian occupation, the United Federation of Planets is invited by the Bajoran Provisional Government to administer joint control of the station, which initially orbits Bajor. The station is then renamed Deep Space Nine. According to co-creator Berman, he and Piller had considered setting the new series on a colony planet, but they felt the space station would appeal to more viewers and save money that would be required for on-location shooting for a land-based show. However, they were certain they did not want the show to be set aboard a starship, because Star Trek The Next Generation was still in production at the time, and, in Berman's words, it just seemed ridiculous to have two shows, two casts of characters, that were going off where no man has gone before. In the pilot, the station is moved near the mouth of the newly discovered Bajoran wormhole, allowing access to distant, unexplored Gamma Quadrant. It quickly becomes a center for exploration, interstellar trade, political maneuvering, and eventually open conflict. While its predecessors intended to restore the status quo ante at the end of each episode, allowing out-of-order viewing, Deep Space Nine contains story arcs that span shows or seasons, and one installment often builds upon those that aired earlier, with several having cliffhanger endings. Micropillar believed this to be one of the series' best qualities, allowing repercussions of past episodes to influence future events and remain with the show, forcing characters to quote-unquote learn that actions have consequences. This trend was especially notable towards the series' finale, by which time the show was scripted, intentionally, very much as a serial. Unlike Star Trek The Next Generation, the interpersonal conflicts were featured prominently in Deep Space Nine. This was at the suggestion of Star Trek The Next Generation's writers, many of whom also wrote for Deep Space Nine, because they felt that the prohibition limited their ability to develop interesting roles. In Piller's words, people who come from different places, honorable, noble people, will naturally have conflicts. So do you guys have anything to add to that idea that Deep Space Nine differed from the mold of Next Generation because these people weren't actually friends or companions or members of Starfleet? Do you think that helped the show?
I think it helped it immeasurably. There's just a couple of points in your opening preamble. Rick Berman was always against the show having continuous plot lines and continuing characters. And Piller and the writing staff just kept doing it anyway, because it got to the point where the Next Generation was on the air and they were prepping the first feature film and they were prepping Voyager, that he just got too busy to handle the day-to-day running of Deep Space Nine, and they would just do it and run it past him because he wasn't around to say no. So the fact that Deep Space Nine developed this mythology and arc was despite him, not because of him.
All right.
And eventually he got to the point when we get to season three, where all of that happens and Ira Stephen Burr takes over as executive producer. He was a big fan of embracing the continuing plotline and the character development. And Berman eventually just threw his hands up and said, do what you want, I don't care anymore, and went off to do Voyager. I don't think any discussion of Deep Space Nine can really be had without mentioning Babylon 5. Babylon 5 started at roughly the same time, was touted as a novel for television by its creator, J. Michael Straczynski. It had a clearly defined story arc that ran for the full five seasons of the show. He says he pitched Babylon 5 to Paramount first, before he took it to Warner Brothers, and then they turned it down, and then suddenly Deep Space Nine was in development. Now, you can say that's coincidence, or you can say that they ripped him off, which is what Straczynski believes. And there are similarities between the two shows. Both are space stations, both are major ports of commerce, both an era wormhole or a jump gate, as it was in Babylon 5. Both deal effectively with political machinations that are going on beyond the main character's control. In Babylon 5, it's more an Earth-Gov situation, that the Earth is being run by a corrupt government more than Deep Space Nine. Didn't really deal with Earth much at all. I personally think there's room for both shows. I think just because you've got one show set on a space station, you can't have another one, seems a bit silly. It's like, how many cop shows do we have on the air at any one time? And how many lawyer shows? It seems a bit daft. And the fact that we've never had another one since these two shows went off the air seems to substantiate that idea that, you know, there is room for more than one of this kind of show. I know initially I preferred Babylon 5, but I think Babylon 5 ultimately was gutted by off-camera decisions that we don't have to get into because we're not a Babylon 5 podcast. Whereas I think Deep Space Nine from season 3 onwards went from strength to strength. But certainly, as I remember coincidences, well, try and point them out, because I have rewatched Babylon 5 since it aired, and I've never rewatched Deep Space Nine. So going through it forward, I may go, oh, right, that's a rip-off of Babylon 5 and Vicky Verkey.
I think we've discussed, I never got into Babylon 5. I don't think I've ever watched a full episode of it. So I'm not going to have that perspective on things. As far as the conflict between the characters, I think it was presented in a more realistic fashion than on any of the other shows, because there is the conflict. I mean, they did do it somewhat on Voyager, where you had the Maquis, that's it. They had and the two ships were combined. But it almost seemed to me that the conflicts were resolved too quickly and didn't really develop in a realistic fashion. In this show, I think there was not necessarily conflict, but there wasn't total trust and friendship between the characters. And you could see as the show went on, it developed, and it seemed to develop organically and in a realistic fashion. And I think it was very, very well written, and I think it is more realistic. I know Gene Roddenberry's vision was, you know, of almost a utopian society, but conflict makes for good storytelling. Lack of conflict usually makes for boring storytelling. So they did have some, not necessarily conflict again, but a lack of trust between the characters that eventually developed into trust and then a family type relationship. And again, I think it was an organic thing, and I think it worked out really well. And this might be the time to talk about what I was saying about how it's not as different from Roddenberry's point of view as it is sometimes purported to be. Because as we were getting ready to do this, I was just looking up some things online, and I saw one thing that said, and I thought it was, you know, pretty, it sounded very realistic or very accurate, but it's something I had never thought of before. And we all know that Gene Roddenberry envisioned the original Trek as wagon train in space, that he essentially viewed it as being a Western type TV show only taking place in a science fiction format. this show is very similar to that, because apparently the creators envisioned it as a Western town where a new sheriff comes in with his son and has to basically tame the Wild West town. And the more I thought about it, the more accurate that seems in the way that it was portrayed, with Sisko coming in as the new sheriff and having to deal with, you know, somewhat an already existing situation and a huge conflict with the Cardassians and then new things coming up with the wormhole. And I think it made for some great drama. I really do. And we're going to see it more as we go through the different episodes, especially as we get a little further in, I think, as we get beyond the first season and the characters really started to find their legs. I think we're going to, you know, really enjoy seeing it as these characters develop. So I don't know if that actually answers your question, Sean, but that's my take on it.
No, it does. In fact, the comment you made about Star Trek supposedly being a wagon train in space, what I heard was they envisioned Deep Space Nine more as the Rifleman in space, where it does, there's a person who comes to this town that's lawless and has problems, and he goes in there and he's trying to fix them. Sisko's not necessarily a person who wants to be there, but he has to be there, and he has to make the best of it. And well, we'll get more into it as we get into the show. But if you're ready, I will go ahead and start up with my synopsis and gubbins about that.
Sounds good.
Okay.
At the edge of the universe, when the future is in peril.
Got Cardassians on our back doorstep.
One man faces an impossible mission.
I will do the job I've been ordered to do, sir.
To protect a defenseless space station.
I don't believe the Federation has any business being here.
Command an untested crew. And to reel in a deadly encounter.
You will disarm your weapons.
Next time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
The Emissary, Parts 1 and 2, aired in the U.S. on or around January 3rd of 1993. As the show, like the next generation before it, was syndicated, stations that picked up the series could air it whenever they wanted to. It was the first Star Trek spinoff that had no official input from Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry. At the time of development, Piller and Berman had spoken to Roddenberry about the show, but never specifically of any of the concepts. And sadly, Gene passed away before production of its first episode could begin. The concept of the show was quite different from the two previous versions of Trek. Like I said, if Next Generation was supposed to be wagon train in space, Deep Space Nine was more like the Rifleman in space. The show was also peppered by a very diverse cast of characters who, unlike previous crews, didn't tend to get along. The main cast included Avery Brooks as Commander Benjamin Sisko, the first lead Starfleet officer who did not hold the rank of captain, René Auberjonois, which I'll always mispronounce, as Constable Odo, the station's chief of security, Terry Farrell as Lieutenant Dax, the Trill science officer, Cyrock Lofton as Jake Sisko, Benjamin's son, Cole Meany as Chief Miles O'Brien, engineer and former transporter chief from the Enterprise-D, Armin Shimmerman as Quark, a Ferengi bar owner, Siddiq El-Fadil as Dr. Julian Bashir, an overly enthusiastic chief surgeon, and Nana Visitor as Major Kira Nerys, a Bajoran officer stationed at Deep Space Nine. The episodes this time out were directed by David Carson, future Star Trek Generations director, with a teleplay by Michael Piller and story by Piller and Rick Berman. The show starts as the Federation fleet engaged the Borg at Wolf 359. Now aided by the assimilated Captain Jean-Luc Picard. Sisko, his son Jake, and his wife Jennifer are all aboard the USS Saratoga during the battle, and like most ships that were part of that conflict, it was destroyed by the Borg, and only Benjamin and Jake escape with the survivors. Jennifer, pinned under some wreckage, was unable to be saved. Cut to 3 years later, when Sisko has been assigned to Tarok Nor, now known as Deep Space Nine, a former Cardassian space station that served as an occupying force during the Bajoran conflict. Upon arrival, Sisko finds that the station has been stripped bare by the exiting Cardassians, and the current station commander, Kira, is distrustful of the Federation presence. To make matters worse, many businesses and people are leaving the station due to the instability of the situation. But with some creative bargaining with the local barkeep, Quark, Sisko and the chief of security, Odo, a shape-shifting alien, manage to convince Quark to remain on the station as a quote-unquote community leader. After transferring personnel from the Enterprise, including Chief Engineer Miles O'Brien, Sisko finally meets with Captain Picard, whom he still holds responsible for the death of his wife. He even tells Picard that he's not certain he's right for this position and might resign from Starfleet, but since he has orders, he will carry them out. Soon after that, Sisko is invited down to Bajor to meet with the planet's spiritual leader, Kaiopaka, who takes him to see the Orb of Prophecy, one of several orbs that were delivered to the Bajorans by their prophets, thank Space God. Looking at the orb, Sisko relives the moments where he and his soon-to-be wife, Jennifer, first met. After his magical mystery tour is over, Opaka declares Sisko to be the emissary, think Space Jesus, who she believes will be the savior of Bajor. The Kai, hoping to convince Sisko, allows him to take the orb back to Deep Space Nine for further study. Back at the station, more crew are showing up, including incredibly hot Trill Dax and incredibly awkward and horny Dr. Bashir. Hoping to find out more about the orb, Sisko gives it to Dax in hopes that she can find a scientific explanation of how it works, and while Dax investigates further, former station commander Goldacott arrives on Deep Space Nine and asks if his crew might take some shore leave on the station, which Sisko reluctantly allows. While the Cardassians are milling around on the promenade, Dax and Sisko, with Odo disabling the sensors of the Cardassian ship, head to the Denoris Belt, in one of the station's Federation runabouts, because Dax discovered several phenomena related to the orb there. Upon arrival, the two encounter a stable wormhole which transports the ship 70,000 light-years to the Gamma Quadrant, an unexplored area of the galaxy. Thrilled by the discovery, the two travel back through the wormhole, but Dax ends up being transported back to Deep Space Nine while Sisko remains in an area between the two exit points. At the station, the Cardassians finally regain their sensor capabilities and head to the newly discovered wormhole. Not wanting her mortal enemies to lay claim to the anomaly, Kira, with the help of Chief O'Brien, rigs the station to travel to the opening of the wormhole, but they arrive too late as Dukat's ship has already entered the wormhole, and it has suddenly collapsed, trapping both Sisko and the Cardassians. While the station tries to defend itself from Cardassian ships that believe Goldacott was destroyed by the station, Sisko is trying to relate his existence to the quote-unquote wormhole aliens and prove to them that he and his Federation allies are of no threat to them. Through the sharing of his life experience, including the tragic loss of his wife, Sisko is able to convince the prophets of his good intentions, and they allow him to leave the wormhole into the Alpha Quadrant with Goldacott's ship in tow. Crisis averted, Sisko and his crew settle in for an era of adventure and excitement, boldly staying where no man has stayed before. And that was a bit long-winded, but you know, two big episodes that were incredibly dense and I mean, really good science fiction stories. You know, the second half where Sisko is having to relay the idea of, you know, linear existence to these, we're not really said if they are gods, if they're aliens, or what they are. And I think that's one of the great things about the show is it's never specifically said what the prophets are. The Bajorans view them as their gods. You know, Sisko being the scientific, or Sisko and the Federation being the scientific minded, you know, view them as aliens. It's nice that you get these two divergent opinions on there, and no one opinion is specifically considered to be right. But what do you guys think about the episodes?
Generally, I thought it was a very entertaining pilot episode. I mean, it's, if we're going to be nitpicky, it's not really a pilot in the true sense of the word. Like Next Generation, it had a first season pickup from the get-go. So it's not like they had to do a pilot and then wait a year and see if they'd been picked up for a series. So they went into this knowing they were at least getting a first season. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It could have been an incredibly confusing script. And yet it isn't. Despite discussing non-linear time, the episode progresses really well and really quickly. And there's a requisite amount of action and adventure thrown in with the COD philosophizing that Star Trek was so good at. And it didn't seem like 91, 92 minutes when I was watching it. I've not watched this since it originally aired, and I was pleasantly surprised by how well it held up. Because I've got this thing in my head that Deep Space Nine is this great show, and it's my favorite after the original, and I've resisted going back watching it in case it changes my mind. So peeking behind the curtain for the lovely listeners, I was the one most reticent about doing this. When Paul and Sean were so gung-ho about it, I was like, I don't know, guys, because I really didn't want to watch it and be watching it going, actually, this is crap. But thankfully, the pilot episode held up really well, and it's really got me stoked for rewatching the series.
I remember watching the pilot when it was first on, and I have this bad habit of multitasking when I'm doing things like that, because most of what's on TV is so simplistic in nature that I can be doing three things at once and still kind of get the total crux of what's going on. And I recall watching it and not quite following what was going on because I wasn't paying close enough attention. The whole alien wormhole aliens thing kind of got lost to me a little bit until the second viewing, because then by the time I had the second viewing, I realized I have to pay more attention to this. Overall, I think it was a very good, and I consider it a pilot episode, not because pilot means, you know, it's a test episode to see if you're going to do it. Pilot just as an introductory episode. And I think it is a good pilot episode because I think for the most part, and I do have some nitpicks, but for the most part, I think they do a good job of introducing the characters. I think they do a good job of showing that these characters have some backstory that you're going to want to know more about as time goes on. They do give you Chief O'Brien as kind of your point of view character because he's coming over from Next Generation and you already know him. And I think they realized quickly that that wasn't going to work that well. And he you know, finds his own legs as a character, but he isn't your point of view character for very long. Mm. My biggest criticism of it is there are points where it seemed like the direction of the episode almost conflicted with the serious nature and dark tones of the story. There were points where some of the interplay between the characters, and the best example of it I can give is the initial byplay between Sisko and Kira. It plays almost like a pilot episode of a sitcom as opposed to a, you know, pretty serious science fiction show. And I'm not sure if it's totally the direction, if it's the way some of the dialogue is written, or if it's even the acting being just a little too lighthearted for what they're saying. It's one of those three, but I ultimately fall on blaming the director for that, because if it is either of the other two things, I think he should have seen it in his daily takes on it and said, wait a minute, we got to fix this, and they didn't. Yeah. And that's one of my biggest criticisms, is just the tone just doesn't always seem quite right.
Well, it was David Carson, and he went on to do Star Trek Generations, which, yeah, is not the best Star Trek movie, so there you go.
Yeah, we won't hold that against him.
It's a nitpick. I don't want to make it sound like that's a huge criticism I had of the show, because I have a lot more positives than negatives.
Yeah, it's interesting. My nitpick was exactly the same as yours, Paul. It was some of the performances seemed a little bit off, which you can probably put down to it being the first episode. But I think, yes, specifically that scene where Kira meets Sisko, I thought Visitor played that, yeah, a little broad.
It almost played to me like Sam meeting Diane in the first episode of Cheers.
Yeah, and given she will become one of my favourite characters as the series developed, I was a little bit off by that. But Avery Brooks' performance in this is a little mannered in places as well. But as you get to the second half, the non-linear stuff, he's magnificent. Mm-hmm. Especially when you consider that for him, all of that stuff will have had to been shot wildly out of sequence. So the fact that that scene just flows so wonderfully as it cuts from time frame to time frame, I think is a testament to him as an actor, because he will have been the one who has to look at the script and go, right, in this bit, I'm in this mindset, and in this scene, I'm in this. And sometimes it's only one line of dialogue. So that bit he's brilliant in. But yeah, his initial meeting with Kira is off somehow.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, I don't want to get ahead of it because we're doing this episode now. But just as this series goes on, I think Avery Brooks had a chance to show his acting chops, and he is an excellent actor, and he shows it time and time again.
Mm-hmm. He does have, I will admit, he does have some scenery chewing moments, you know, especially when he's playing
Charles, he's a Star Trek captain.
Yes,
isn't that part of the job description?
Unless you're Picard, then you're just a giant stick in the mud.
I'll argue that Patrick Stewart had some scenery chewing moments as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Because we go, yeah, and no further.
Yeah, I was just thinking that exact same thing. The line is drawn here from First Contact.
But I like the way that the show started out, and even with connecting it, we said connecting it to the series that came before it, to Next Generation, with having Cole Meany on it. I like that they connected it to one of the series' best episodes, Best of Both Worlds, and have Sisko's major point of trauma in this be that his wife was killed during the Battle of Wolf 359, and the fact that Picard was a part of that, you know, a major part of that, you know, is kind of impetus for him having this negative feeling about Starfleet, and it works through the cycle of the show that he overcomes that and overcomes his feelings about, you know, what happened at Wolf 359 that allows him to maintain being on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, my main question about that, where the hell was Counselor Troy with this guy who clearly needed a counselor? For 7 years on Next Generation, she did bugger all. Yet here was this guy going through this major trauma, and nobody ever thought to send him to the counselor that resides presumably on every ship.
I thought in this particular episode, and this doesn't answer your question, I'm sorry, Andy, I'm kind of changing it back a little bit, but I thought in this particular episode, and the writing-wise, they were trying just a little too hard to shoehorn in Captain Picard. Because it didn't seem like he would be the guy giving Sisko the mission, but they had him do that. When does the Enterprise pull up to a station, give a Starfleet officer a mission, and then leave?
Yeah,
when was that ever Picard's job duty?
He would have just received his mission from an admiral. Exactly, he would have got a communique from an admiral. I mean, the only reason Picard's there is because they say they're dropping off Chief O'Brien. And arguably, you can say, well, he would have dropped off Chief O'Brien and buggered off. He doesn't really have any need to get in touch with Commander Sisko. And the fact that you only saw Patrick Stewart, especially when Chief O'Brien visits the bridge of the Enterprise, stood out like a sore thumb. Because at no point during the Next Generation's history was somebody on the bridge where at the very least Data wasn't there.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, Picard would be fully aware that Sisko was at Wolf 359. I mean, that wouldn't be a mystery to anybody.
No, that would be in his psych files.
Absolutely, and if you were to believe that Picard is the one handing him his mission and telling him what to do, then Picard would have his file right in front of him. He'd have a pad with all the information, and that would be a thing that would jump out at everybody. Hey, wait a minute, you know what? A Locutus over there. This is one of the guys. You killed this guy's wife.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the real reason is they wanted Patrick Stewart in the episode to sell it.
Mm-hmm. I think they could have done a bit of a better job coming up with a reason for him to be there.
Yeah, I mean, something as simple as Deep Space Nine isn't receiving any external communiques because the Cardassians have trashed the station. One line of dialogue would have solved the problem. Mm-hmm. So Picard is giving in your mission.
That makes sense. But yeah, I agree. It's just a reason to have, you know, an anchor from the Next Generation come in and sort of, you know, send your show off. It's
having Fonzie in the first episode of Mork and Mindy.
Exactly.
Patrick Stewart is the Fonz. Yeah, when he has his little natty cardigan on as well instead of his leather jacket, that'd be pretty awesome. Do we want to talk about the cast a bit, seeing as this is the first episode? Because
yeah.
I don't know about you,
certainly in
every Star Trek series other than the original, which obviously I wasn't alive for when it first debuted, so they were always, after I saw them in other things, they were always, oh, it's Mr. Sulu. But in this one, unlike the other shows, with the exception of Scott Bakula mainly, pretty much all of this cast were known when they debuted. They'd all mostly had a pretty decent career before Deep Space Nine, which is probably why most of them have gone on to have a decent career after Deep Space Nine. Certainly Avery Brooks, I knew from Spencer for Hire.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And René Auberjonois, who plays Odo, was a familiar face on television. He was in Bionic Woman and Wonder Woman and Starsky and Hutch and Rockford Files and all those stuff that you watch when you grow up.
Most famous for Benson.
Yes. I didn't remember him from Benson, but maybe I just never watched Benson.
There's going to be
shame, I did.
And even Nana Visitor. I remembered Nana Visitor. She did an episode of Knight Rider and Murder, She Wrote and Scarecrow, Mrs. King. You know, all those trash television things you watch when you're a kid. Remington Steele and Hunter. So she was a familiar face. So it wasn't one of those you don't know the cast from anything. But the fact that none of them carried with them any baggage from something else, I think this is one of the best, if not the best, entire cast of any of the Star Trek shows. The original is Kirk, Spock and McCoy and the others of the Seven Dwarfs. And Next Generation, let's be honest, you keep Patrick Stewart, Brent Spiner and Michael Dorn. The others are interchangeable. You could get rid of any of the others and it wouldn't matter. And Voyager, less said about the captain of that show, the better. So as a whole, I think this was the best ensemble cast of any of the Star Trek shows.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and not only ensemble cast, but as we get further on to the series, we'll get the secondary characters becoming major parts of not the, like, the title card cast. You know, the secondary characters, like, you know, we'll get into Garrick eventually. And,
yeah.
Gul Dukat and the Kais, the very different political and spiritual leaders down on the planet of Bajor. You know, these characters... Mm-hmm. And the Grand Nagus, Wallace Shawn is just awesome. Phenomenal in this. But
even James Darren.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when we get to the time tunnel guy.
And we'll also get Klingons. Here's one thing, I don't know if you guys caught this. He only spoke for a second and I didn't notice it until they did the end credits that the Klingon commander of the Saratoga at the beginning of the show.
I think you meant Vulcan Commander at the beginning of the show. Thank goodness I'm here to catch your mistakes on this show as well.
Was actually, I think, J.G. Hertzler, who eventually would go on to play Gowron. Not Gowron.
And we covered him last episode.
Yeah.
Yes, the other one.
Bartok. Bartok, yes, that's it. So I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, also, as well, I thought it was really neat Nog was in it from this early on.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Nog for later on, for being part of the show because of his relationship with Quark's brother. Mm-hmm. But I'd forgotten he was in the pilot episode, as was Mark Alamo as Gul Dukat.
Mm-hmm. And Rom was in there. He didn't have any speaking roles, but you saw him packing up, and you could tell that it was him packing up the bar at the beginning of the show as everyone was getting to move off the promenade. But yeah, I think you are correct. This is one of the best ensemble cast, and you know, it may be because they did have a series or had acting experience prior to this that they weren't sort of shoehorned in as, okay, for the rest of your life you're going to be known as X character from Star Trek. So I think that definitely helps. The only character that I thought was kind of underused in the show was Jake. He really didn't get to do much. And you really didn't get much, you know, much backstory other than, you know, his dad's, you know, a captain or not a captain, a commander on the station, and then he's lost his mom. He gets a little bit of chance to act during the whole wormhole alien sequence, but his character will get played up later in the show. So
yeah, at the time of this episode, I kind of thought Jake was window dressing. I didn't think we were going to really see too much of him. He was, just. Almost, you know, like I said, the son to kind of be there just to show that Jake, that Sisko had the family ties and obligations and responsibilities and that they weighed heavily on him. But I didn't anticipate Jake becoming a significant character. And he actually becomes fairly well developed, you know, it would have been really easy to make him just want to follow in his father's footsteps. And instead you had Rom wanting to become the Starfleet officer, and Jake really had no interest in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't conflicted with his dad because of that, which also would have been a little bit too much of a cliche, I think. You know, the father who desperately wants his son to follow in his footsteps. I think Benjamin supported his son's desires to do other things, and we'll get into that more when it happens. But I think the show did a good job of not falling into cliches.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I think that the Sisko relationship, Benjamin Sisko's relationship with Jake, is one of the best depicted father-son relationships on television. Because they have their problems, but it's not out-and-out dysfunction like on Galactica, which I've said before, is that there wasn't a relationship that show couldn't make dysfunctional. Whereas in this, he has problems with his son, and his son does give him grief as the show goes along, as our children do. But I think their relationship is fantastic. What's interesting about them two as well is that Avery Brooks very much approached it as, I'm playing your dad, and he had a word with the guy who plays Jake's, I can never pronounce his name, so I'm not going to, Jake Sisko's real parents have said, I am going to touch and I'm going to kiss him, and I'm just making sure that's okay with you, but I'm playing his dad. And I think it's important to show this relationship between these two characters. And they both said, yeah, okay, go for it. And I think that's nice, that he's not embarrassed about showing affection to his son in public.
Mm-hmm. It really did feel like a real relationship, a real father-son relationship. You never doubt that they actually love each other.
And Jake feels like a real kid at times, something Wesley never did.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the writing on Jake was much better. What's another interesting thing in terms of the casting was Star Trek was very colorblind in its casting. The captain was written as the captain, and they saw male and female actors for the role, and they saw Caucasian and non-Caucasian people for the role. And when it was Avery Brooks, the discussion was, do you have a daughter or do you have a son? And Avery Brooks' contribution was, I think a father-daughter relationship has been played out. Let's do a father-son, because mm-hmm. I don't think that's been done on television before. And that's an interesting part of it. They cast the best guy for the job. It wasn't written in the description of the character what his race was. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, that is. I agree.
Yeah, it is nice that it doesn't feel in any way forced that Sisko was chosen, or the not Sisko, but Avery Brooks was chosen as a character to be on the show because of his color or because of his ethnicity. It felt like he was just the best person for the role, and I think that's always the way.
My understanding is that Voyager was the same. They had the role of the captain, and they hadn't decided whether it was going to be male or female or not. So Star Trek did have this reputation of being properly integrated in its cast, and it wasn't tokenism in any way.
I thought with Voyager they did have more of a desire to set up a woman captain, because Kate Mulgrew, they had Genevieve Bougeot as the captain.
Yeah. So. They certainly had an idea they wanted a female captain to be the first female captain in a regular show, but they weren't married to the idea.
No, thank God that they didn't go with Genevieve Bougeot, because I saw some of her screen tests, and yeah, she was not right for the part.
I've seen photographs of her in the uniform and all, but I've never actually seen any footage.
They had a little bit of footage from what they the Caretaker episode that was basically her interacting with Tom Paris, and yeah, it wasn't very good. She was even more stiff than the person who played Janeway.
Kate Mulgrew.
Kate Mulgrew, yeah.
Well, I always felt whenever I've seen her actually act in anything, I guess her primary language is French, and that English is her second language, because she always sounds very stilted when she speaks.
Mm. Well, maybe just the French Canadian, that she speaks that more frequently than she does English. That would be let's see.
We're not a Voyager show.
Thankfully not. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. What do we think of the teaser?
Okay. The Wolf 359 footage?
Yeah.
That pulled me right in. I like that they brought you in with something you've seen before. Especially, this is a complex story, so it's something good to kind of open your eyes and make you kind of interested in what's going on right away.
Well, and it's been a while since I watched the Best of Both Worlds episode. I don't think we got to see much of Wolf 359. We got to see some of the after effects of it as the Enterprise came through and saw the destruction of it, and we just basically heard, like Starfleet communications of what was going on. This gave us an actual, sort of physical look at the battle, and I really thought it was a great way to pull the people in. It does kind of feel like they're, shooting in their load for this first episode of, getting you as much special effects in as they could, but I thought it was a good way to hook you in on the series. Okay, Paul's taking a little break.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was waiting for him to jump in. The teaser is really quite an expensive-looking opening. The Best of Both Worlds, we saw that from the Enterprise's point of view, and the Enterprise wasn't involved in the battle at 359, which is probably the only reason it wasn't destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a fan edit of Best of Both Worlds, as far as I understand it, that integrates this footage back into the Best of Both Worlds, but I've never seen it, so I don't know how well it fits into that, but it's certainly an interesting idea. It's interesting that they start Deep Space Nine off with this idea that the captain is, what's the word I'm looking for? it's not seething hatred, but he doesn't like Picard from the get-go. Whereas every other Star Trek captain's this bastion of purity at this point. So the fact that they're setting the stall out before the opening credits, that this guy was married and Picard's responsible for his wife's death, whether he was Lacutis or not, you know, Sisko probably doesn't see any distinction there. I thought that was a very interesting
character. It seemed pretty clear that he didn't see it.
No, he was very openly contemptuous of Captain Picard. He almost borderlined on insubordinate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, him coming in there and basically saying, you know, looking at him and saying, "Oh, we've met before in battle," and you know, I mean, that's you know, if I'm certain in a military operation, if a lesser ranking officer came up to a commanding officer and gave that to him, he'd be there'd be consequences going on with that. One of my favorite characters on Deep Space Nine is Odo. I love Odo. I love Rene Auberjonois. I can never pronounce his last name. But I will admit, even though the special effects for the opening teaser with Wolf 359 looked really amazing, the effects for Odo haven't held up quite as good.
No. I was watching Terminator 2 last night on TV. It just happened to be on. And the morph effects in that are still pretty damn good. But obviously they had a feature budget. And it's probably no coincidence that Deep Space Nine didn't have Odo morph that often.
Yeah. And you can also tell that they hadn't really perfected the effects or the makeup effects for him, because it doesn't look like, you know, in the prior episode where we were covering Way of the Warrior, that Odo looked like they just shellacked him with, you know, you know, the makeup, and basically he had no features. This one, the makeup isn't applied as liberally. He looks more humanoid, so I guess
he's got clearly defined cheekbones in this one, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, and he doesn't
which has
have
to make it easier to act when you can, you know, just convey more facial expressions.
I do wonder why they covered Rene Auberjonois' face with all that latex when he's got a magnificent face.
Mm-hmm.
He's not somebody who's ever felt the need to have a shit ton of plastic surgery. So he's got this wonderful, weathered, lined face. I think he looks brilliant. He's full of, you don't want to say the word character because it sounds like you're insulting the guy, but his face is brilliant. And it is a shame that for the majority of Deep Space Nine, they covered it up.
Oh, yeah. See, other characters, we touched a little bit on Kira, and especially her beginning introduction to Sisko, and that being kind of, like you said, sort of like Sam and Diane in Cheers. She does grow as a character, and I think having a powerful female works better in this series, especially with her background, you know, of having to fight off the Cardassians and all that. I think Kira is a more interesting leader than Janeway ever was. And maybe we can discuss that. Maybe you guys have a bit.
She's a more interesting character because essentially she's not grown up the privileged Starfleet lifestyle. She's grown up on a war-torn planet, being attacked on a daily basis, fighting for her very existence. So she's going to be bitter and twisted. And she is, when the episode begins, she's abrasive and borderline unlikable. And I think it's only towards the end of the first season, that magnificent episode duet that I'm really looking forward to covering because it's one of my favourites of the entire 7-year run. It's that one where she starts to soften. And I don't necessarily think she needs to soften. You know, I don't mind abrasive women. I'm quite fond of short, feisty women. Which is probably why Kira is my favourite character on the show. But it certainly adds an extra dimension to her character that she's capable of change. And I think that's symptomatic of everybody on the station. Nobody in this pilot episode is the same by the time we get to All That You Leave Behind at the end of Year 7. Every single one of them has changed in some way. Some physically. Avery Brooks loses weight and loses his hair. But the character is a different person, and I think the journey of Deep Space Nine is probably best followed through Kira's eyes, because she was there before the Starfleet guys were, and if you follow the novels after the series goes off the air, she takes command of Terra Noir.
Hmm.
And we've got those brilliant episodes coming up where she's in the Mirror Universe.
Oh, yes.
Those are a ways away, though.
Yes.
Yeah, but they take me to a happy place.
But I think she's one of the least compelling or developed characters in this particular episode. But I do think, I agree with you totally, that as the series goes on, she becomes extremely charismatic. And I don't think she really softens so much as we start to see that she is a three-dimensional character and she does have a softer side. I don't think she ever actually softens, though, because I think she remains a fierce adversary to anyone in her inner circle. And she, it's never like that she becomes weaker in any way, shape, or form. But I do think that she becomes a much better character as it goes on. In this particular episode, I thought she seemed very two-dimensional. She's there to be conflict with Captain Sisko, even though technically they're forced to work together. Again, a little bit of too much Sam and Diane for me.
Well, there's also that everyone is aware she was supposed to be Ensign Bro Laren.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Right, yes, so yeah, so and Michelle Forbes turned them down. She didn't want to do a regular series. Why she would turn that paycheck down is something I've never understood, but obviously she's not as mercenary as I am. But Michelle Forbes turned them down, which necessitated a rewriting of the script. And ultimately, everyone came to the conclusion that it worked out better for the show. Because if it had been Ro Laren's a Starfleet officer, and the conflict would have been muted by the fact that Sisko was ultimately her commanding officer. And if she was saying anything he didn't like, he could just order her to do it and she would have to do it. Kira essentially is not under Commander Sisko in terms of chain of command. She demurs to his position on the station, but she doesn't have to agree with him, and she doesn't even have to follow his orders. And it makes for a more interesting dynamic, because essentially he's got this first officer there who doesn't have to listen to him if she doesn't want to, and can get in his face when she thinks he's wrong. Ro couldn't do that.
And that's one of the great things about the show, is you do have that conflict between the characters, between the leaders of the show. And not only the conflict that deals with not only the political conflict, but the politics of religion, you know, the various number of things that come on in the show that allows it to be different from Next Generation. When you've got this one Federation starship where everyone is a member of Starfleet, you have to follow the rules of the chain of command. With Deep Space Nine having people that aren't a part of Starfleet or aren't a part of the Federation, you're allowed to get that conflict, and that makes it for a more entertaining show and a more engaging show.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think it definitely created a nice dynamic. And even as their friendship develops, as the show goes on, and they do trust each other and they do believe in each other's motivations, they still have differing goals at times. And she never backs down from saying what she thinks they should do and what her agenda is.
One of the other characters that I think we ought to touch on just a little bit is Quark the Ferengi. And the one with Odo being one of my favorite characters on the show, having Quark as sort of not really Rick to Odo's, I'm trying to remember
Peter Lorre's
character. I do like the idea of Quark being this sort of underhanded, deceitful guy, and I think Shimmerman does a pretty good job of it. What do you guys think about Quark in this episode?
He's not really got a lot to do in this episode, has he? I mean, this goes back to what Paul was saying. Essentially, it's Sisko's episode, which is right and proper, because you've got this bigger cast of characters. You can't focus on all of them in one 90-minute pilot, so the decision was made that this story would be about Sisko. And if a story is about change, then the character who is different at the end of the episode is Sisko. So this is his episode. Mm-hmm. And so Quark's really quite minimal. He's there to have conflict with Odo. He's there to be a bit of a snake. And he's there to get blackmailed by Sisko into staying on the station.
Point is the biggest one. That third point I felt was the biggest point of his character in this episode. He's introduced, but you really don't learn too much about what he's about, other than the fact that he's a Ferengi and he's got family on the station and that he runs the bar. That's about all you know about him at the end of this episode. But I think his real purpose is to be a mechanism to show Sisko and how Sisko is going to work, and to make Sisko a more deep character, in that we already know that Sisko is resentful of even being given this assignment, and you're wondering how he's going to handle it. And immediately he comes up with the strategy of, you know what, I'm not going to take it easy, even though that's the normal way to do it. You know, Nog is a young kid and we'll just let him off. No, I'm not doing that. I'm going to use this because now I have a bargaining chip, and I'm going to use this to make sure that Quark stays here and continues to run the bar, because I think that's what's going to help me to get to what I need to do at this particular station.
Well, and
I thought that was a great character bit.
It shows how Sisko is willing to work outside the sort of guidelines that the Federation put on him, because the Federation would, you know, say this person has to be in jail. But, you know, Sisko realizes that there is more than just, you know, the black and white of he committed a crime, he needs to be in jail. Sisko's put him there because he knows that if Quark leaves and if all these other people leave, the station is going to fall apart. And he needs someone there to be, like, as he say, a community leader, but to keep the businesses open. So he's not adverse to essentially blackmailing Quark, which I think, you know, is a nice thing of his character, that he doesn't feel the need to completely fall in line with Starfleet rules and regulations, which is something that has to happen out on essentially the frontier of space, where Starfleet isn't going to play a major part in a lot of these stories.
Well, that's going back to what we were saying on at the top of the show, that it's very similar to the original in that it's a Western, but a different kind of Western. Sisko's back to being cowboy diplomacy. And he's realizing that sometimes the letter of the law isn't the best way to run the town. And justice and vengeance are two completely different things. And he will do that much more as the series goes along. There's a magnificent episode, is it 5 years down the line, where we actually see what Sisko is willing to do to for the greater good. Mm-hmm. And it's a much more hard-hitting decision than ever Picard ever had to make, and maybe even more than Kirk.
Oh yeah, I think I know which one that you're talking about. And I'm looking forward to getting to that, because that's around the beginning of the Dominion conflict, or during the middle of the Dominion conflict, where they're trying to bring in the Romulans, if I'm thinking.
Oh yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about too.
Speaking of sort of wasted characters, Julian Bashir, he will become a more interesting character. Like most of these people, his character will grow and increase. But here he was just like the horny teenager. I mean,
well, that's the way later on they tried to always present him as being that, but somehow the character became more in depth than that. They would always talk about him as if that's what he was.
So knowing what we do know now about how Julian later comes into his character, do we think that all of this was sort of a ruse? Do you think that they had...
Sorry, I interrupted you before you were finished. My understanding is, even though they didn't want to do story arcs and continued characters at this point in the show as extensively as they ultimately did, they did have this plan for Julian Bashir, that he would start as the cocky young stud, and over the course of the series he would become a much more caring and considerate character. In this first episode, he's not interested in being a doctor, he's not interested in helping people, he's interested in action and adventure. He wants
to be a rock star.
Yeah, he's interested in where the action is, and over the course of the series he would become a lot more, he would become deeper, he would come to realize that being where the action is isn't necessarily a good thing, and he would be humbled, he would fail on occasion, which the other Star Trek doctors never really did, and it makes him a more interesting character when you look at the series as a whole. But certainly in this first episode he comes across as a jerk, but that is deliberate. Mm-hmm. Alexander Siddig, or Siddig El-Fadil as he is in this episode, played him as a jerk in the first couple of seasons because he was told the character's arc.
Well, that's good to hear, because, you know, as we know where he's going to progress and what's going to be discovered about him, seeing him in this initial episode, it kind of makes me think, well, was he playing this up? And now that you mentioned that, it's nice to know that was sort of the case. I'm trying to think of the other characters.
Character I'll touch on that I think is the polar opposite of the way he was presented, Dr. Bashir, is Gul Dukat. I think he hit the ground running as kind of a, not necessarily mustache-twirling villain, but as a complex villain who is charismatic and is always going to be basically playing a game of chess with Sisko. I think, like I said, I think he hit the ground running, and I think he started off great, and he continues for seven seasons as a great character and great actor.
Yeah, well, he's the best kind of villain, though, in that you can fully see his point of view. Mm-hmm. You can see and understand why he's doing what he's doing. You can understand why people follow him. He's a magnificent orator when he speaks. Mark Alamo just has that slimy, silver-tongued politician's delivery that while you're watching him, you're sucked into what he's saying. It's the Bill Clinton effect, where people have said that Clinton is a magnificently charismatic character if you're in a room with him. You're just sucked into his orbit. He just has that ability to do that to you. And Mark Alamo as Gul Dukat has that. He's just enormously charismatic. He's not in this episode very much, but the scene that he is in, he steals completely from underneath Avery Brooks. Mm-hmm. But to Brooks's credit, he lets him steal it because he knows that that's his scene. And as Dukat goes along, you start to see exactly what it was he was fighting for. And he's not a two-dimensional bad guy because you understand Kira's point of view, but you also understand why Dukat was doing what he was doing. And you realize that there's really not that much of a difference between them. It's that old cliche. We're very alike, you and I. You know that Bondian villain thing?
We're two sides.
Not a lot of difference. Yeah, there's not a lot of difference between the hero and the villain. What they're fighting for is essentially the same thing. But the way Dukat's going about it is wrong. He's Ra's al Ghul. There's nothing wrong with what he's doing from his point of view.
Absolutely. Not every good villain, because sometimes you just have, you know, the character who's just destroying things. But a tremendous number of good villains, if that character were writing their biography, their own autobiography, they view themselves as the hero.
Well, more nuanced villains. You can have villains that are just out, oh, I want to destroy the world. But, you know, nuanced villains like Gul Dukat have a reasoning behind it and have more of, you know, more of a reason for what they're doing rather than just they're evil. It's not your typical, you know, like I cover over in the Vault shows, you know, horror films where it's just the person hacking and slashing at him. The Gul Dukat is more deceptive. He's more deceitful. But Alamo plays him in just such a wonderful way that you can get sucked into the fact that he is a likable, dislikable character, if that makes any sense.
He's very like Andy Robinson, who will come on as Garak. He's playing subtext with every line that he delivers. And that's a magnificent actor that can do subtext, so that what you're seeing in their face is drastically different from what the voice is saying. And he's like that all the way through. That what he's saying is magnetic and compelling, but you're looking at him going, I don't trust this guy. It's the politician effect.
Mm-hmm. The only other character that we really haven't touched on, well, we didn't really touch on Cole Meany as Chief O'Brien, but the only other real character that we haven't touched on has been Terry Farrell as Dax. What do we think about her introduction to the show or her coming into the show?
She's hot.
Yes. But she's not as hot as Nana Visitor. I'm sorry. She's not.
This is going to be a point of contention.
This is going to be a running gag between me and Paul throughout the entire run, isn't it? Kira versus...
Eventually Terry Farrell leaves, so then you win.
Oh, I don't know. I thought her replacement was quite the hottie as well. But, that's just me. And she's just there to be Sisko's confidant. She's his Dr. McCarty. And I think that she, I knew her from an episode of Quantum Leap, and she was a model before she was an actress, so I don't know if she had an extensive resume, but she does actually...
I don't think she did at this point.
She does an extremely good job of playing an extremely young and attractive woman with hundreds of years of life behind her. And I think it's an acting gig that she's never really received full credit for. And it does add to that wonderful dynamic between Sisko and Jadzia that he still sees her as an old man.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Which they give you just enough information for you to understand what he's talking about and why, even though you really don't know what their prior relationship was, other than that they had one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even throughout the 7-year run of the series, they never fill all of that in, which is good. We don't need to know everything about every character.
In fact,
over the 7 years, yeah, we'll get little bits here and there as it pertains to future storylines, but they will never tell us completely what Sisko and Curzon Dax's relationship was and why he was so important to him.
In fact, they'll have more relationship between Curzon or Jadzia Dax and the Klingon characters that'll come on in the future episodes. So you'll get actually more, you know, relationship or more history between those characters than you really would between Sisko and Dax.
Yet more fun episodes that I'll look forward to doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that we didn't touch upon yet is, and it's really a very basic introduction, but we meet the Kai.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, again, we don't really learn too much about her, and she never becomes all that significant of a character. Although
she'll get replaced by Kai Winn, won't she? Who is
a much better character.
Yeah.
Oh yes,
and in her own way, a villain who's not a villain.
Mm-hmm.
But what she is again another mechanism to just introduce us to some plot lines, because through her we learn basically about the orbs, we learn about the prophets, we learn about
the celestial temple.
And then that takes us to the wormhole, which gives us even more things, and they give you just enough taste of each of these things to make you say, what's that all about? I'd really like to know more about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so well done in that regard.
It is an exquisitely put together screenplay for the first episode of a series. It gives you everything you want. It gives you just enough information to make you want dessert. And the show as a whole will do that throughout its entire run. And I think it's great. I just want to... Chris Honeywell recently was talking about picking up non-fiction books. I recommend, if you can find it for cheap, because I did, there's a huge pocketbooks trade paperback by Judith and Garfield Rhys Stevens called The Making of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which essentially goes into great depth into the creating of the pilot episode. And it's, well, if you find it on eBay for dirt cheap, pick it up, because it's a really good read, especially if you're interested in television production.
Mm. I'll have to check it out. I was looking to see, you know, because when I was doing notes, I was having to sort of crib it together myself. I was looking to see, I know Amazon has a Kindle version of the Nitpicker's Guide for Deep Space Nine. I'm thinking about picking that up, especially if I go through the Two True Freaks link at twotruefreaks.com. Plug. The one scene that really worked for me most in this episode, or the scenes that worked for me in this episode, was Sisko trying to deal with communicating with the prophets. I think this is what really cemented Avery Brooks and Sisko, the character, as one of the best captains out there. Because just think about this. Trying to describe your existence, your human existence, from being born to growing up, to your personal memories, to eventually dying, to entities that don't know what that means. It's essentially like trying to describe colors to a blind person. And he does it in such a brilliant way that if I was to do that, if I was tasked to do that, I would be completely gutted. I wouldn't be able to do it. You know, the wormhole aliens would have kicked me out and I'd be floating in space, you know, adrift. So it's one of my favorite scenes in Deep Space Nine and in science fiction. And it's an incredibly sci-fi concept. What do you guys think?
That scene, watching that over, I said to myself, this shows that Captain Sisko is smarter than I am. and that's the conclusion I was left with, because not like in a very believable way, he understands what their problem is with linear time, and he explains it and verbalizes it in a way, you know, where the concept is so just difficult to grasp, and he manages to explain it in a way that makes sense. So you know, I didn't take from that, oh, this is just exposition and they're, you know, running with it and it doesn't really fit. It seemed very, very natural the way he did explain it. And again, that's what I walked away with, was the sense that Captain Sisko is not only a man of action, but he is very, very intelligent.
Okay, go ahead, Andy.
No, I was just going to say, it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show. This is a very complicated idea got across in an extremely... It's not simplistic, but it's communicated to the audience coherently enough that we understand exactly what it is he's talking about. And Brooks delivers it pitch perfectly.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, and this will be a setup for later things in the episode, that Sisko used the metaphor of baseball to try and explain linear time to the aliens. And, you know, we'll see in later episodes how baseball plays a major part in Sisko's, you know, basically out of uniform life. You know, and in fact, we'll get in season 7, a really good episode that deals with the station playing baseball against a Vulcan crew, which is, I can't wait to get to that. But, just
we got
the
a long way to go.
Yes, we do. But, again, Paul, you're absolutely correct. I couldn't have ever been able to make these relationships or to tie these, make these correlations to these things that are natural in my life and explain it to these people who have no concept of time and make it work for them. So, again, it's exceptional writing, and, you know, it gives Sisko not only, you know, a characterization that is that makes him an intelligent character, but it makes him, you know, an incredibly scientific character that he can come up this on the fly. So it's awesome. There you go.
Another aspect to take into account is, again, I felt that they intended to give Chief O'Brien a bigger role in the show than ultimately he ended up getting, and I think you saw that when they go to move the space station, and he's basically running the game at that point. And I think they saw that, you know, he's a good character, but that doesn't quite work.
This boot that I referred to earlier on, it does say that when they came up with the idea of porting O'Brien across, he was going to be our gateway character because we'd followed him from Next Generation. And by their own admission in this boot, the writers say that didn't pan out. That didn't work out. O'Brien and Cole Meany ultimately found their own niche on the show that was nothing to do with that, and so they just ran with what Cole Meany was comfortable doing, and they just abandoned all of that completely. So you're right to have spotted that it was there in this script, but ultimately they abandoned that idea completely. O'Brien was supposed to be the character we followed as the everyman character, and they kind of abandoned that very early on, and he essentially becomes the Scotty or the Chief Tyrrell. The guy who just keeps the station running by any means necessary. But with O'Brien, the interesting stuff with him as we go along is more his family and his dynamic with Julian.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he did find his niche, like you said, but I think it took a little time for them to realize that he wasn't going to be the character that everybody was going to relate to and want to see more of.
Mm-hmm. Well, and sometimes, you know, they can't accurately predict that, you know, from the show. They can't say, oh, this character is going to be the breakout character that everyone's going to identify with. So it's difficult to do that. But, you know, like we said at the beginning or earlier in the show, all of these characters do grow and change throughout the series. There's not it's the one thing that I think Star Trek The Next Generation had going against it was none of the characters really developed all that much, or developed at least to the level that the characters in Deep Space Nine did. So that's one of the reasons why I think Deep Space Nine is the more entertaining show for me, at least, to watch.
I think that's the reason it's aged the best. It still holds up in the current television climate, whereas I've got to be honest, I don't think Next Generation does for the most part. Other than, I mean, this episode was written by Michael Piller, and Paul's mentioned that it's incredibly intelligent and tight script. I don't think Piller gets his credit in the Star Trek pantheon that he should do. It's when he took over running Next Generation on a day-to-day basis, that's when the show started getting good. as of the beginning of season three, and the seasons that he oversaw as executive producer and story editor, seasons three and four are generally the best episodes, the best seasons of that show. And then he came over to Deep Space Nine and essentially did the same thing again. So for me, unfortunately, he died very young. I think he died in something like 2001. So he's not lived to be able to say, yeah, I did that. And he doesn't get the credit he deserves for essentially coming up with this idea. Deep Space Nine was his baby. He came up with the concept. He came up with the characters. And he wrote the pilot and set the series Bible. And I think as we go forward, we should give Mr. Piller as much credit as we can. Even though ultimately when we get to season three, he's off doing Voyager. And even I don't think he stayed with Voyager very long.
No, because they moved to, I think Jerry Taylor came in and did show running with Berman as well. I don't know if Ira Stephen Bear really did much with Voyager, but I remember Jerry Taylor
was Deep Space Nine all the way.
Okay, so it might be Jerry Taylor who came in and sort of replaced Piller for that. But again, we're not a Voyager episode. We're not a Voyager
episode. But, there's no reason we can't refer.
That's true.
Yeah, we're talking about Star Trek as a whole. There are going to be times when we cross-pollinate, especially in Deep Space Nine, which harkens back to the original far more than any of the other shows did.
Oh,
with
definitely.
Klingon episodes that you mentioned earlier on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of fun stuff coming up. Do we have any final thoughts or anything, or you want to wrap this one up?
I thought this was a really engaging and interesting pilot episode. It's not Deep Space Nine at its best. But then very few pilots are a show at its best. The pilot is there to introduce you to the characters, introduce you to the setup of the show, and if you're lucky, you'll get a story as well. The fact that we get all three perfectly judged in 92 minutes of television is a testament not only to Piller, who wrote the script, but to everyone involved with it. There are a couple of loose, rough edges around as we go through. Nana Visitor hasn't quite nailed Major Kira yet. Julian Bashir is a jerk, but he's supposed to be. O'Brien's not settled into what he will become, and Quark has very little to do. But in and of itself, I think it's Star Trek's best pilot episode after the original series, Twosome of the Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before.
I would start giving my thoughts, but I think you hit everything I have to say. It's just an excellent pilot episode that gives you reason to want to watch more. And like I said, it was done in an intelligent fashion where in order to properly watch it, I couldn't sit there and multitask and do other things. I needed to focus my attention on the show, and that's in a positive way. So
yeah,
all in all, I think this is it hit the ground running, and it really is a great start, despite the nitpicks that we hit on. But, you know, if you eliminate the nitpicks, then why are we talking at all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and why do a podcast about it if we're just going to say it was great?
Exactly. It did have some problems. Some of the characters weren't fleshed out as well as they could be. But for a ensemble show, which I think Deep Space Nine is one of the best ensemble Star Trek shows, they did a good job at giving you enough of the characters to make you want to come back and learn more about them. Basically, the story arc for this show was Sisko getting over the loss of his wife. And, we really didn't even talk all that much about his wife, Jennifer. I can't remember. Felicia M. Bell played her, first of all.
Well, essentially, she serves the same purpose as Bruce Wayne's parent. She's there to die.
Yeah, she's mm-hmm. Krypton, basically. She's
blow her up for the opening credits.
Mm-hmm. And then she's given one basic scene on the beach where you're meant to view her as a compelling, beautiful, exciting character for Sisko, and I think she fills that role. I think you start seeing, okay, I can see why he's so attracted to her, and then if their bond is as strong as it is, ultimately you could see why he feels the loss so much.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So I think she does serve her purpose.
Yeah, she does exactly what she's supposed to do. The actress is great in the role. She certainly fills out her bikini very well. Mm-hmm. I'll say that to her. But she also plays that whole hard to get thing that, let's be honest, as men we love.
Oh, yes.
So you can see why Sisko starts to pursue her. So you understand the relationship with only one or two scenes. So it is exceptionally economical, but very well done.
I love some of the dialogue between them, when like when she talks about her mother and he just says, she's gonna love me. I just thought of some of it was very, very well written at that point. And just a final thought, because I didn't say it before, is a lot of our nitpicks on this show aren't because you would watch this as a pilot and say, oh, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. It's more because we have
the benefit of hindsight
and knowing what these characters are going to become, and we're seeing some inconsistencies in how they were portrayed early as compared to the way they into you know as to what they turn into, and that's where some of the nitpicking is coming from. But I don't think a lot of the complaints or nitpicks that we hit on, if you were watching this and you didn't have the benefit of watching seven seasons of episodes, you might not even have those criticisms at all.
No, I think watching this without having any prior knowledge, I think for the most part, you could probably watch this and enjoy it and go, that's a very entertaining science fiction television series. I will tune in for more next week. Yes. The only thing we've not mentioned, an extremely important recurring character, Morn.
You do see him in there.
Even Morn is there.
He is here. Yeah, even Morn is here from the very beginning.
So yeah, we'll have to chronicle the development of Morn throughout the show.
Maybe we should make that a running tally that we go. How many, you know, are there any episodes where we don't see Morn? I'm not even sure how many there are.
Well, that's a good idea. We'll have to count that, because he was in the Way of the Warrior episode, so he was in this one. So we'll have to make sure. Maybe Morn is the character that shows up in the most episodes of the show. That
perhaps he's
keep
the point
a Morn
of view
tally. Yeah.
So
Morn's
far,
the one who's there from beginning to end.
he's the anchor of Deep Space Nine. That's it. The show is essentially about Morn. The other characters just sort of revolve in and around him. There you go. But that's if you guys don't have anything else, I say we close this one up. What do you think?
No, yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Next time, we will be covering the next episode or two, depending upon, you know, what we feel like doing. But we'll probably be back here in about a month talking more about Deep Space Nine. So if you'd like to, again, write into us, tell us how we're doing, tell us what your thoughts on the episode are. The email address is listentotheprophets@gmail.com. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
See you next month.
Bye-bye.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were carrying on with the email.
Okay. Carrying on with the email, sorry.
Okay, are we gonna just kind of totally come clean on the whole Assistant Editors Month? And
you can take a drink. Sorry, that was my daughter's up here. Yeah, I basically...
Hello, Sean's daughter.
Andy says hello.
And Paul.
Hi.
And Paul says hi.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
I think this has to make its way into the show.